Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Bite Electric smart home products make everyday living simply smarter. Add color to your home's exterior with LED outdoor string lights. They're perfect for holidays or get-togethers, and they can be scheduled to automatically turn on or off. View our entire selection of Fight Electric smart home products today on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer for other great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
Welcome, welcome everybody. As always, this time to our October FOMC panel for 2025. The economy continues to serve some contradictions going on here. Growth hasn't really collapsed per se, yet inflation continues its refusal to bow down and bow out of the fray. The labor market's showing patches of fatigue as well, which we'll definitely touch on in more depth later on in the panel. All this while the government shutdown is delaying key data releases, leaving the Fed to fly partially blind here. There's also still the global friction persistence from trade tensions to energy supply jitters. And like I said, we're going to touch on all of these topics today. We're going to dive right in to some introductions and get this thing started. So starting us off with our panel of experts today, welcoming back our go-to Fed guy, Joseph Wang. You know we love having him here. Headed the Fed's Open Markets Desk. Has a great introductory book I like to plug on every single one about central banking called Central Banking 101. He's the CIO at Monetary Macro and a staple of our FOMC panels. We've got our man, the last bear standing, another long-standing friend of the spaces, an expert on markets, and he also writes a lot about monetary policy and individual names that he's watching and tracking in his weekly Substack. If you're not subscribed to that, go do that. A lot of good information there. Welcome back, as always, Last Bear.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. Hopefully, we resolve some of these issues, but we got a fun FOMC ahead of us with some unusual wrinkles this month with the shutdown and QT and rate cuts, so it should be a fun one.
I'm really looking forward to this one, too. I think we're going to have a little bit of spice going on in our discussions today. Next, we've got Martin Pelletier. He is the portfolio manager at Trivest Wealth Council, an often columnist for the Financial Post, an avid skier, as I always like to point out, because I can barely walk down my stairs these days. Welcome back, Martin. I'm excited for this one.
Hey, thanks for having me. Just give you a little bit of a heads up that Prime Minister Carney asked me not to talk about Ronald Reagan and tariffs, okay?
Now we're going to be robbed from it because the Prime Minister said so. Don't do that to me, Martin. Up next, we've got our man, Johnny Matthews, Mr. Super Macro himself, another homie that's a friend of these spaces. I love having him on here when he's able to. Over 25 years of experience investing and trading under his belt, with about half of that time spent with a macroeconomic focus. He currently also has a site, blog, and service, Super Macro, constantly publishing in-depth market analysis and economic developments that affect the macro landscape. Welcome back, Johnny. Great to have you as always, and I'm glad we can hear you.
Thank you, Nicholas. It's great to be back on the show, and I agree. I think this is an interesting Fed meeting. We know what the outcome will be, but I think, you know, there's a very divided committee now. So the statement and Powell's press conference will certainly be interesting.
And it actually kind of looks like the market's holding its breath this time too, this morning beforehand. We're just kind of chopping in a little range here within the gamma exposure cone for XPX, for anybody interested in that nerdy stuff. Next, we've got our man, Jem Carson, a leading volatility expert that I always love having on here. Founder of Kai Volatility, has a lot of stuff going on over there at Kai that I am not entirely up to date on. I know you guys launched a bunch of new shit, Jem. What have you guys got going on? And as always, welcome back, man.
Million plates spinning over here. A lot of great things. But everything from broader different asset allocation models that we're running on an investment advisory side to upcoming ETF, which I cannot talk about yet, but will be very exciting. So a lot of wonderful things. Today, the Fed is increasingly becoming a beholden political entity. You can argue it always has been. But I think the pressures that are being placed on it are making the outcomes much less about will they, won't they, as a function of what they should or shouldn't do, And so that'll be interesting to talk about as a, you know, I think it changes the conversations around it, but I think there's a big set of ramifications of that today, which we'll probably get into, but excited to be here as always. And it's been a while, so this will be fun.
I am roaring and rearing and ready to go, Jim. Thanks for coming. All right. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to go ahead and jump right into things. To start us off here, the September CPI rose 3% year over year, with core inflation moderating only slightly and rent inflation showing its smallest gain since I think all the way back in January of 2021. Now, everyone listening probably noticed that I said September CPI there, not October, even though we're used to seeing CPI come in before the Fed decision, before the FOMC meeting. The federal government, as you all know, has been shut down since the first of the month, which has halted major data releases from pretty much every major data agency, like the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, kind of leaving policymakers and markets without key economic indicators. Now, with that in mind, I'm curious, how is the Fed really navigating decisions without these entities? I know in some cases, there are private sector proxies like ADP jobs, ISM surveys, those exist. But do those really substitute and fill in the gaps needed to dissolve any potential policy errors? Can we really trust that today's Fed decisions reflect the reality of U.S. conditions without these entities giving us the data? Let's start off here with Martin, if you don't mind.
Yeah, you betcha. I think there's enough data to work around what's missing. If you take a look at, and we talked about this before, you have a small percentage of the population driving consumption, and you've got a lot of consumers that are struggling out there. And the AI CapEx boom is not working its way into Main Street. What really amounts, if you're looking at an AI world, is that only 1% of the population is benefiting from what we're seeing here. And the bottom population is struggling. You had UPS disclose that the company's eliminating 35,000 jobs. Above the 20,000 that it was expecting previously. Amazon's cutting jobs. GM has laid off some employees. Target's doing some layoffs. And then of the overall numbers, if you take AI out of the equation, you have GDP that would be fairly flat. You got California and New York that's carrying the entire economy on its backs. And so you have this widening gap between the wealthier and the poor. And so the inflationary pressures from wage inflation and that sort of thing would be not as strong as what it has been historically. And the tariffs haven't been passed along to, I'm going to talk tariffs, but not from a Canadian perspective, but from an investor perspective, that haven't been passed along to the consumer as of yet. And we're working its way through trade agreements with only three countries, I believe, left to finalize some sort of agreement, and Canada being one of them.
Thank you. Johnny, do you have anything to add to that? I'm especially curious about the point of view from the BOE, if applicable here, because I know that I know that they released a statement pretty recently kind of focusing on macro some, and I'm curious what you're feeling on that front, Johnny.
Well, I think the Bank of England has very different challenges to the Fed. In the UK, a lot of the inflation was driven by government policy, minimum wage hike and council tax and utility bill increases in April that really pushed up the CPI. So there was a lot of policy driven inflation that's got into the system, and we have a very high inflation rate, 3.8%. And so the BOE is taking quite a cautious approach to cutting. But I want to come back to the US. It's a very different situation. And I'm not so sure the US is really struggling as that much. I mean, if you look at, first of all, second quarter GDP growth, 3.8%. Q3 looks like it's going to be on track for a similar pace of growth when we eventually get the data. prior to the, you know, the government shutdown, we had two very strong months of consumption growth in July and August, strong enough that the Atlanta Fed was projecting a consumption growth of over 3% in Q3. So from that perspective, I think consumption is the main driver of economic growth in the US, and that is still pretty strong. Investment also plays a large part, and that that certainly is going gangbusters with all the investment in AI infrastructure. And when it comes to the labor market, I think when you've got growth running at 3% or so, it would be a very, very strange situation if labor demand were to fall off a cliff. Now, as you rightly said, we have alternative indications of the strength of the labor market. We've got weekly jobless claims. They're not published, but the states are still publishing statewide jobless claims, and you can add them up and make the seasonal adjustment and get a very, very good idea of where the weekly official jobless claim, weekly initial jobless claims should be. And they are still running very, very low. So layoffs are running at a historically low level. We know that hiring has slowed, but it was really pumped up after the pandemic. When the economy opened, there was a massive surge in hiring, and it has been normalizing ever since. And if you look at the JOLTS data, the job openings data for the last year, it's kind of been flatlining. It's been up and down, zigzagging along a horizontal trend. And job openings at the last print were still higher than just prior to the pandemic. So in my view, labor demand has cooled, but it hasn't collapsed. It really hasn't collapsed. And when it comes to the other side of the Fed's mandate, the inflation, I agree, we are missing quite a bit of data. And there are different dynamics taking place. Obviously, the tariffs are a one-time price level adjustment, but that will take some time to feed through the system. Going in the opposite direction, rental growth is still slowing. I think it was an exceptionally low print that we had in September that, you know, probably won't be repeated in October if we do get the data. But either way, I think as far as the Fed's concerned, the Fed is concerned about the slowdown in job growth, and the Fed is going to cut and probably cut again in December. But I don't think that the cuts that are priced in by the market for next year will materialize. I think we'll get stronger signs of labor demand over the next few months, and inflation is going to hang around at about 3%. And I think the market has really over-egged this.
So just as like a little follow-up there, Johnny, and then of course, as always, anyone in the panel, feel free to chime in. Just on that topic there of the labor market, layoffs, et cetera, we have seen in the last month or two a lot of pretty major companies kind of, not necessarily hinting, so in a couple of cases it's pretty explicit, at some pretty major layoffs or restructuring going on. I know Amazon specifically just said something like 75% of operations to be automated is their goal. And they're also laying off, I think they confirmed, they initially said around 30,000, but they confirmed at least 14,000 corporate positions. Is this something that we should be concerned about at all? Or is this just kind of like a cyclical thing for these large corporations?
I don't think you should get too focused on these announcements. Challenger Gray and Christmas, it's an outplacement agency. They publish a monthly count of layoff announcements. And what typically happens is companies announce so many layoffs and they never actually follow through with that number of layoffs. And to put the numbers that you've mentioned into perspective, every month about 5 million people leave their jobs, and a bit more than 5 million go to new jobs. Some of those are layoffs. Most of those are voluntary changes, but the labor market is still very, very dynamic. So off the top of my head, I don't remember the typical number of layoffs that you get in any 1 month. But, you know, when you talk of a large company making a high profile announcement of job reductions, say numbers like 30,000, it's going to be spread out probably over the next year. They probably won't actually go ahead with that many layoffs. And I think it's trivial in the scheme of things, really. Tens of thousands when you're talking of a total employment of something like 160 million. So it's always important to keep a perspective. They may be very high profile companies and they may look like big numbers, but in the scheme of things, they're not that big.
Thank you, Johnny. Does anybody have any agreement or disagreement there? Feel free.
Hi, guys. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, Joseph.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Dad. Awesome.
Let's go.
Well, first off, thanks so much for having me. And that was a great explanation by Johnny. One thing I'll also add is that something interesting we found out from Chair Powell last week is that according to the Fed's internal estimates, you know, the break-even job creation number each month, it's like 0 to 50,000. So that's a pretty low number. Now that they're basically saying that even if we made zero jobs a month, you know, that wouldn't be too awful. And that, of course, is because they think that population growth has slowed down a lot. And so I agree with Johnny that, you know, maybe the rate cuts next year will not, market might be a bit more aggressive to that since inflation still is above target and has been for quite a long time, as our friend Bob would say.
Thank you, Joseph. Thank the Twitter gods. We can hear you now. Your input's going to be great for a lot of these questions I got coming up. So I'll be picking on you a little bit here soon, Joseph. So just kind of back onto inflation a little bit here, I want to touch on shelter and rent. Now, shelter and rent inflation is still pretty sticky. It's one of those ones that's really kind of clinging to and not giving in much space at all as time goes on here. But it does appear to be moderating at least a little bit. And so I'm curious, with things like housing, which is very big, buzzworthy word, and yeah, there are plenty of issues, and we also know that some of these things are based on regions within the U.S. as well. Some of like the coastal cities have significantly inflated costs of housing, and other places the availability is not there. But my question here is, are these trends finally signaling genuine relief in core inflation via this slight moderation we're seeing in pricing of housing? Or is it merely masking persistent price pressures elsewhere? Last Bear, do you want to take a stab at that bad boy?
Yeah, sure. So I do think that there have been some recent indicators that have shown rent prices starting to tick down, at least in terms of the, you know, growth rate, down from, you know, if you looked at the last decade, it was probably around 3% on average. And it has kind of went from, you know, a very high number in the early part of the pandemic, or, you know, 2022 timeframe, down to something like 3%. Now it looks like it's coming down to something more like 1%. So well below sort of the average of the prior year. Granted, that's after a period of pretty substantial inflation nationwide. But I do think that there are elements of, housing absorption. So basically, there was a ton of multifamily in particular starts that happened and sort of that boom in rent prices a couple years ago that are now hitting the market. I think the market is, at first, it was pretty good at digesting that new supply. But I think that is starting to fade a little bit, especially when you take into account the population dynamics that some folks were referring to earlier, where basically population growth over the past couple of years was highly driven by immigration. And that's obviously slowed to almost a total halt in a pretty short period of time, at the same time that you have a lot of new units come on. Now, at the same time, renting still is substantially cheaper than buying with financing, with a mortgage. And so there's a pretty massive gap if you're thinking about what's the price to own versus the price to rent. And if you were to consider that maybe those should converge somewhere in the middle, then you could argue that, you know, there's still plenty of room for maybe housing prices to come down and rent prices to maybe continue to creep up. And obviously how that's reflected in CPI would sort of be somewhat of an offsetting factor. future. But I do think that there are some more real-time signs that there is cooling in rent. And given how big of a portion of the CPI or PCE price index that is meaningful to the overall index level. And at the same time, obviously, there's still the sort of the lagging effects that everyone talks about, which is sort of a methodology issue. But, you know, that we're just sort of continuing to, in some ways, catch up to the old numbers by having higher than real time numbers. But that continues to be sort of a direction and, you know, a push in the downward direction. So I do think that that's a major, you know, component of CPI, but it's also one that's probably pretty well sort of understood or forecast. I think that there's also, you know, it's a little bit more uncertainty around how things like the goods going from a negative CPI to, you know, inflecting back to a positive. How much of that is tariff related? How much of that is just sort of a reversion to the mean? How other services are going to, you know, react going forward? Obviously, the reality is the Fed has been nowhere near the target for 4 or 5 years, and yet they're cutting into it. So the other dynamic is just what you know, what their actual target is and what their tolerance is for being above it seems to be pretty substantial. So I don't think that changes the near term of you know, cuts for the next couple months, but we'll see if more persistent inflation changes that next year.
I'll jump in here. I think that rents are going to continue to drop. We're seeing that more pronounced here in Canada. For example, on the oversupply of housing and condos in Toronto, the replacement value is $1,200 a foot, and stuff's being sold off market without impacting the price. It's $690, $675 a foot. So there's a material drop there, but we're not seeing that being reflected in prices. In the U.S., you look at mortgage rates, they've fallen from, you know, at the 2023 peak of 7.8% down to 6.2%. But housing prices are still up considerably. I think I read somewhere around 40 to 50% since 2020. And so mortgage payments as a share of income are above 30% compared to 20% pre-pandemic. We won't talk about Canada because it's a lot worse. It's like closer to 40%. If you look at the inventory lockout effect, you've got, you know, 80% of homeowners hold mortgages at least 100 basis points below current rates. So that's discouraging some sales and freezing supply. And so that's going to keep some of the prices higher. And so, you know, rents will continue to drop, I think, across the board in the U.S. And certainly very much in Canada.
I'll actually hop in here and say something. I think the one thing we're really not highlighting is here we're talking about kind of real estate and these markets kind of a monolith. And I think more than ever, we're really, really experiencing massive bifurcation in the U.S. and global economy, not just, you know, rich versus poor, which is part of it. But really, you know, it's almost segmented into different corners of the U.S. even, right? Like real estate is doing incredibly poorly in the some of the corners that were dependent on international demand. You know, think of it as, you know, the Pacific Northwest and California and Florida, right? There's some other aspects that are hitting things there, natural disasters, et cetera, as well. But when you go back into kind of the middle of America and certain parts of America that have not seen some of the growth over the last several decades, you're seeing a lot of strength, actually. So you're actually seeing a real interesting bifurcation there. Some of that is really this bifurcation between, you know, the slowdown that we're seeing in the economy is really a function of the bottom 50% and the demand there. It's also centered around a younger cohort, which we've seen happening for some time. The frustrations of those groups, by the way, which has been causing a lot of political upheaval, are not, whereas that we were sending money to those people, now we've really reversed that in the last year or so. And so there's some really interesting kind of dynamics at play. I think, you know, top 10% of all earners are now 50% of consumer spending. That's up from 35% just in the late 1990s. So this is a very different economy. The more the market goes up, that wealth effect is very real. That wealth effect is supporting higher home prices on the top end. Meanwhile, you're having credit issues and all kinds of a slowdown happening on the bottom. So it's really market by market, and it's really, price by price. You're seeing a very, very bifurcated different real estate market. And that really applies not just to real estate, but really broadly across the economy.
Thank you, Jim. And you bring up a good point as well in regards to just kind of general consumer resilience, I think. Credit delinquencies, for example, been rising significantly, everything from credit cards to mortgages. And Fitch actually just said that auto loan delinquencies have reached their highest level in 14 years, for example. So it's kind of telling there. But I guess in more of a broader scope, what does this tell us about consumer resilience? Is this like a passing phenomenon, or are we seeing hard evidence now that the wages versus inflation ratio is starting to kind of floor the consumer?
I think it's tied much more. I'll just answer that real quick before somebody else hops in. But much more tied to the market than ever. So I think everything is so levered to market action and liquidity now, but that's equally going to be the case to the downside. I mean, that's always, the market's always had a wealth effect. It's always been important, but the size and scale of liquidity created by the market now and the importance to it, to the consumption in the market, is just dramatically higher than it's ever been. And so I think, you can, simultaneously, it's kind of hard to hold in your head, but see credit issues, see defaults in part of the market, while you could see simultaneous strength in another part. And that's kind of hard to hold in your head at the same time. But I think that is a bit of what we're seeing at this point.
Makes all the times that I tripped chewing and walking gum at the same time seem pretty trivial at this point, I would say. So I want to kind of just detract a little bit here back towards inflation, just kind of as a general overview, specifically on the tariff posturing. So the ongoing tariff posture and that recent data, mentioned earlier from September, kind of suggest that supply side inflation is still hanging out there and it's still a risk. Is such an issue as inflationary, as some economists argue? And kind of tag along on to that, if tariff-driven costs do lift headline CPI alongside cooling demand, is there an argument to support further pauses at these meetings? Let's go Martin on this one.
Oh, boy. No kidding. That's probably a better one for some of the other panelists here. If you look at how much has been passed along to consumers, I think the St. Louis Fed said about 35% have been passed along so far, and that's expected to rise about 55%. And then roughly 2/3 are expected to hit consumers. So we haven't seen the impact yet. And so I think it's just a matter of time and data. And I do think it will impact the U.S. consumer. It has to. And the closer we get to getting away from this taco reference and seeing the reality of it, the greater the chance that this is finally going to get passed along to the consumer. And so the big question is how long will it stay, or how much is it going to be, and how long is it going to stay? And I think consumers, they don't give a shit about, month over month or quarter over quarter. They're looking at their living expenses from 3-4 years ago, and they're like, everything's like 25% more expensive. You see pictures of people posting, groceries online, and I'm probably one of them because my wife sent me to the store the other day, and I was shocked. So I think that's the reference. And so there isn't the appetite for it. So that's the pushback against passing it along to the consumer. So we'll have to see. If it does, then it definitely will impact, and it will have a supply side inflation risk. Absolutely.
Anyone have anything to add to Martin's points there? Really good response, Martin. Thank you.
I do want to make a couple of points just to put things in perspective here. US consumption is 70% services and 30% goods. And about 20% of the goods that are consumed are imported. So that's really, you're down to about 6% of consumption. Now, Fed studies show that actually about 10 or 11% of total consumption is comprised of imported goods. So that's a relatively small proportion of the total consumption basket. So these tariffs, as painful as they are on, for some people, on certain products, they're not having a massive, massive impact on the overall price level. And I don't want to sound all sort of Marie Antoinette here, but, you know, the for most of the most households, I doubt that these tariff hikes will have as big an impact as many people fear. I think the much more dramatic impact was the really sky high inflation that we had following the pandemic that that really pushed the consumer price index up a long, long way. And certainly it's not coming back down again. I'm shocked when I do some grocery shopping in the US, stuff is so expensive. It's quite staggering. And I know it's kind of like a regressive tax in that, you know, the lower income households spend more of their money on food and so on. And to the extent that that food is imported, yeah, it's going to hit them harder. But I think the tariff impact has probably been less dramatic than a lot of people expected. I think the average effective tariff rate that that many economists are calculating at the moment is running at about 12 to 13% lower than what the Yale Budget Labs expected, because either there's import substitution or the wholesaler, the distributors are absorbing the hit in their margins. But whatever the reason, we're not seeing such a massive impact from the tariffs so far. And I suspect, you know, it will be a one-off hike in the price level that we'll get through this in about 6 months or so. By then, you know, the whole of the pass-through should have taken place. And I suspect, you know, the pain will be shared between the exporter, between the importer and the distributor and the consumer. So it's not going to be a killer for the economy. Let's put it that way.
I do think there's some truth to that. I think the bigger issue is immigration. I think we've completely shut down the southern border. Our average annual immigration for the last 4 years was about 2.5 million new people coming to the United States. I think that is an incredible amount of this labor supply. You know, it was about almost 2% of the labor supply per year. That stopping is a big deal. And, you know, to the point that services are the bigger part of the economy, that is the supply of services. And I think that actually is a much bigger effect probably going forward. And I think that's something that people aren't looking at it enough. We have on the tariffs also done a lot on the back end that doesn't get talked about to mute the effects of them. There have been a lot of exceptions. It's not just the public delays and this and that. But I do think that is something that's important. And the other part, you know, that I think is, again, not talked about as much as it should be is the increased spending on military and global conflict. I think that was a huge part of the 70s inflation, Vietnam. And I think that's an increasing thing we're seeing consistently, even though we've pulled back on other fiscal spending on the big, beautiful bill. I would also expect that short-term effect will reverse as we head into the midterm next year, as it'll be hard to hold the line for Congress on spending as we move forward here. So some things to think about on the inflationary front that are above and beyond the headline tariff conversation that everybody's talking about. But I do think I agree with those points about tariffs. For a lot,
I'd like to jump in, and I don't want to take over here from directing questions, but I'd love to hear Joseph's thoughts on what we just, like, if you look at services, including shelter, yeah, it is 65 to 70% of CPI inflation. And you have a small percentage of the population driving like a vast majority of consumption, and housing remaining strong, But if you look at households and what they own as a percentage of their portfolios in equities, it's also quite high. And so if you have is Joseph, do you think the Fed's looking at the market where it is right now and the highs? And, you know, we're going to obviously talk about the shift from tightening into easing, given what's happening in the repo market. But, you know, what are your thoughts if the Fed, you know, are they looking at the market continue to move higher? And is that going to drive continue to drive services inflation?
So a lot of us, I mean, a lot of us make our living off the market and we are you know, watching this every day. But so we are focused on the market going higher and higher, and then we're looking at the Fed cutting and thinking that's really weird. But from the Fed's perspective, that's not really their focus. In the past, recently, Chair Powell has made comments that the market has seems to be, you know, a bit overvalued. But I mean, from their perspective, first principles, it's full employment and price stability. And if you're looking at how they try to impact the economy through interest rates, it's through interest rate sensitive sectors like housing, where people buy homes on a levered basis. So financing is important, and autos to some extent as well. Now, if you look at housing, you know, new construction homes, permits and so forth, housing has basically been in kind of a recession for the past couple of years. Home builders are able to sell homes because they're buying down rates, but you know, that really has been slowing down a lot. So from their perspective, if they're more worried about labor, then, you know, you have to cut rates to try to help the real economy. And yes, maybe that makes financial assets go to the moon, but, you know, that makes people happy, right? You shouldn't just not help the sector of the economy that's actually tied to your mandate just because financial assets go even higher. But with respect to inflation, something else to keep in mind is that when the Fed is doing, they're looking at tariff inflation, all that, they know that it's a one-time change in the price level. And according to orthodox central banking, they're supposed to look through it. But they can do that as long as inflation expectations are stable. And according to the indicators that they're looking at, it's still stable. So they're not too worried about tariff inflation at the moment. And as many people have noted, you don't really see that much. And it's looking like it's playing out really just like it played out in 2018 and 2019, whereas the increases in tariffs were largely gobbled up by the distributors in the form of lower profit margins. We hear a lot of anecdotes that people would like to pass those costs on, but also hear anecdotes that consumers are pushing back. So it doesn't seem like, at least at the moment, they have that ability to pass it on.
I actually tend to think that that they're completely looking at markets, and you know, they'll never say that publicly. The rhetoric will never say that they're managing markets, but there's no denying that the greatest driver of liquidity on the planet is, and it's always been important, but by far the greatest driver of liquidity on the planet is not the Federal Reserve, it's not the U.S. Treasury, it's financial markets themselves. I mean, we have, you know, $500 trillion of long assets in the world now, and now 10% of, you know, the top 10% of the population in terms of wealth drives 50% of consumption. I don't think we can say, you know, with the market with $500 trillion of assets up 20% for the year, that $100 trillion of new collateral that gets fed into the system is not something that the Fed or the Treasury are looking at. I think Bessent et al. In particular are incredibly focused on that. This has been a very, I think it's hard to deny that this hasn't been a very engineered liquidity push in markets to drive them higher. And I think the explicit reason is to support the economy in the context of tariffs, immigration policy, a lot of other things. And I think ultimately, yes, it'll support the part of the economy, the top 10%, and there'll be some trickle down in the short term. But you know, the question is will that lead to inflation or not? And how does that look when it eventually comes under the weight of its own, you know, how high will it go before at some point, right, some type of reversal? You'd think there'd be some gravity at some point. So that's the problem with this whole system. And I think they're very aware of it. I think the Fed is trying to figure out how to manage that circumstance. But I think they're beholden to the administration at this point, clearly. And I think that's the bigger issue. So I think it'd be silly to not look at their effects on the market and the market's effects net on liquidity in the economy at this point.
Beautiful discussion there. I don't think there's really anything I could add to any of that. And we actually chipped right through a couple of questions I had. So I do want to just kind of touch real quick on one more inflation-specific question, and then I'm going to move us back over toward that discussion on the labor market, labor slack, as it were. But first, we've brought this up a few times before in the past, and this is just about, once again, that good old-fashioned 2% inflation target that we've discussed. And analysts have argued in some ways that the Fed has already, quote, won the fight on inflation because long-term inflation expectations have remained anchored throughout pretty much this whole ordeal, at minimum the last couple of years now. Now, if inflation readings do continue around that 3% currently, or even start slipping upward again, as some are concerned, happening with the tariff discussion amongst other consumer issues that are popping up, how are we really feeling about the Fed's credibility on that long-standing 2% target that I know has been harped on again and again? But I wonder, is that number even something worth discussing, or are we going to turn into Clark Gable? Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. Last Bear, what are your thoughts here?
I think it's probably kind of what you said. I mean, if there was a strong desire to that you needed to literally hit the 2% in order to justify cutting, that's what would have happened. And clearly there's, easing, both the signaling of easing, which I think started back, I would argue, back in 2022, once you started to see inflation hit its peak and start to come down off, you know, granted it was still 8%, but it had come down from 9%. You started to see in the dot plots that the expectation was 3 years out, rates were going to start to come down. And so you saw, you know, the market, that's when the stock market bottomed. That's when financial conditions started opening up again. And so there's, you know, the loosening has been happening for quite some time. And obviously, even at this point now, we haven't gotten really close to hitting that target. And so it's clearly a decision of, you know, run it hot, so to speak. I think even, you know, Bessin has basically said that. And those words are similar recently, where we're going to grow our way out of it instead of, trying to really clamp down on it. Now, granted, we had, you know, conditions that were very disinflationary. Both you had a big reset in goods demand in the sort of 2022-2023 timeframe off of, you know, an extraordinarily elevated base. You had energy prices, you know, oil go from 120 to 60. You had a lot of positive factors that led to the disinflation that we saw. Now, going forward, those levers aren't necessarily there. Potentially, in some ways, housing and, you know, the shelter is probably the biggest component that's still left to, you know, potentially come. But we already went through a period that should have seen pretty rapid disinflation, and it did, but it brought it from 9% to 3%. So clearly the Fed's actions, historically over the past several years and their indication about what they plan to do today and over the coming months indicate that the 2% is not something that really is going to guide their decision, other than, you know, being able to sort of credibly, you know, continue to say, or, you know, until they lose credibility, I guess. So it's clear that it's not a target that needs to be achieved.
So would you say, just as like a quick little follow-up, would you agree with what some economists have said in that 3% has become the new percent? And that's kind of why some pundits are pushing that narrative that the fight of inflation is over and we've won.
Yeah, I think that's what the Fed has signaled in their actions, if not their, you know, while not their words, in their actions.
Thank you, Les.
Well, go ahead. Bond markets are telling you it's not over. Bond markets are pushing back. Bond, you know, you've seen three cuts. You've seen a number of cuts here this year. And and bond markets are still, bond yields are still staying high. So, I mean, have they, you know, we're talking about, you know, if they cut 25 here, and but bond markets say don't give a shit.
So actually,
there's a major,
oh, Jim, go ahead.
Sorry. I was also going to say, there's also major, you know, there's been a departure. You know, if you look at the long bond in the United States versus global, you're also seeing kind of different directions. And I think that tells the story of what's happening in the U.S. liquidity wise. There's a concerted effort to, you know, provide liquidity to the long end of the curve here in the U.S. And you're not, when you're not seeing that, you know, bonds are staying higher, like Martin mentioned. So I do think that some of this is the canary in the coal mine is not, you know, is that these things aren't really being able to be moved internationally, and we can manage them. But I don't think the inflation expectations are nearly as low as markets might be saying. Under the hood.
I want to make a couple of points. First of all, these elevated inflation readings are not just in the US. You know, the UK is close to 4%. Australia this morning printed 3.5%. Sweden's above 3%. Japan's close to 3%. Canada, Germany, 2.5%. So, you know, the 2% target is not being achieved across a lot of the G10 countries. And when it comes to the long end of the curve, I think I'm actually surprised at how relaxed investors at the long end have been. And in fact, the very long end of the Treasury curve, the 30-year, has been outperforming the likes of Japan and the UK and Europe recently. But I think if you look at them over the last couple of years, the ultra-long bonds, they are really performing badly. And pension demand is really waning very, very fast. There's pension reform taking place in Europe that's going to reduce the demand for really ultra long dated government bonds. And I think at the moment, even with the yields where they are, I think there is a risk that that long end of the curve becomes unhinged, because I think it's becoming increasingly evident that 3% really is the new target. It's no longer 2%. 3% is good enough. And certainly, you know, and I've said this for a long time, the Fed is really not going to sacrifice the labor market for the sake of driving inflation all the way down to 2%. You know, the Fed, if they wanted to, could put the economy into a recession and we get inflation down to 2%. They're not going to do that if they can possibly help it, which is why we're in the situation we are in today, where 3% is okay, as long as the economy keeps growing and the labor market stabilizes.
I think the elephant in the room that we have yet to discuss, which was probably the most important thing to discuss, is the forced resignation of Adriana Kugler, the attempted firing of Cook, the projected takeover of the Fed, I think eventual takeover of the Fed, even if they don't have complete control, the administration has projected, which is just as important that they do, to markets. I think that's played a huge role in the market reaction at the long end of the curve. I think the other major important part is, you know, you can look at the numbers and say, well, they don't have complete control yet. They have, you know, 3 out of 7 and maybe 3.5, depending on what happens here with Cook. But what they've projected also to the governors underneath the hood is that they are willing to go to any means necessary to extract the policy that they want. And you can't help but think that politically that is going to play a role in the decisions of the Fed governors. And as we all know, in May of next year, which is not that far away at this point, Powell is highly likely to not have his job. And the leadership is also to change. So I think that is the most important thing going on. We can talk, you know, on top of that, the, you know, what seems like a concerted, you know, effort to not, you know, release the numbers or to kind of run the numbers that they want the market to see, creates a very different situation for the Fed. This is not the Fed of 6 months ago, a year ago. They are not as independent. And importantly, we know from history, You know, Arthur Burns is a cautionary tale. You know, the firing of William McChesney Martin in 70-71. And then the, you know, lowering in the face of sticky inflation, not too dissimilar than we see now. The lowering of interest rates aggressively by Arthur Burns. You know, he lowered interest rates from 9% all the way down to 3% into 71. 6% decrease drove 3% from 3% inflation all the way up to 12%. And so I think the administration, importantly, not, you know, which by extension includes the Fed, is signaling and very clearly, if not explicitly, very close to that, that they are really going to run a debasement program. They're going to choose in a stagflationary environment the economy over inflation. And I think to everybody else's point, the market is telling you that underneath the hood. They're trying to, at the same time, manage the pricing here in the U.S. of the long end of the curve and those expectations. From sheer force of supply and demand, whether it's changing the duration on the Treasury side or through the Federal Reserve, but you know, at some point, that is going to be very hard to control. If you get negative interest rates at the back of the curve, that will be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So, I think that's the most important thing that we haven't discussed. You know, we can talk about will the Fed, will it, won't the Fed? I don't think it's about inflation or growth, really. It's not a decision. It is about policy and a projected policy and desire by the administration.
Thank you all. A lot of great points there. I want to hark back here to something someone mentioned earlier on in that discussion about the treasuries. It's a bit of an aside here, but Martin, you had an absolute banger of a thread on Twitter covering the issuance of T-bills by the U.S. government and some of the concepts around QT, quantitative tightening. If J.P. Morgan's comment last week that the Fed will end QT this week, what exactly does that mean if true, and what connotations will that carry? Is it a sign of, hey, we're good to go, or a little bit more complex than that?
Thank you so much. I'm going to get Joseph's thoughts on this because his Substack was the catalyst for me going down that rabbit hole and taking a look at the repo market. You know, the reverse repo has been drained. That's done. MBS is not going to move. And then you've got the repo market that with repo rates rising. And then who's going to end up in the end having to buy all of these U.S. treasuries because the Trump government is spending like a banshee and hasn't curtailed any of that. And they're going to have to pay for it. And how are they going to do it if public markets aren't going to do it for them? Is it the Fed? Are they going to start stepping in and buying treasuries? And this is, you know, I think – I'd love to get Joseph's thoughts on and hand off the baton to what he thinks.
That's a really good point, Martin. Joseph, it was the October 27th issue, I think, that Martin's referring to. You broke down the Fed's focus on repo rates, and at one point noting that although the available amount of repo financing is, lack of a better word, enormous, it's still not enough to keep up with demand. So yeah, Joseph, definitely would love to hear from you on that.
Well, first off, that was a great Twitter thread by Martin. I should talk about. So I think there's some discussion that one of the big things that could happen today would be the end of quantitative tightening. And if not today, it'd probably be the next meeting. The reason for that is that...
Quick, Joseph, it sounds like you're getting some clipping here and there. Can you just keep that mic right close to your mouth? I think it's giving a little distance feedback.
Okay, is this better?
Yep, that's perfect.
Okay, so one thing to note is that one of the big things that could happen today is that today could be the end of quantitative tightening, and if not today, maybe the next meeting. The reason being, as Martin mentioned, is that there are signs that maybe the Fed might be going too far and shrinking its balance sheet. So one of the things that the Fed is trying to do is to make sure that there's enough liquidity in the financial system, just enough so that the banking system can function. It doesn't really know how much that is. So the way that they go about doing this is to look at market-based signals. And one of them they look at is repo rates. So as Martin mentioned, we had a lot of money in the reverse repo facility. It's like a repository for excess money, excess cash in the financial system. That's been drained to zero. and we see repo rates basically trading notably higher now above interest on reserves. And that scares the Fed a little bit, because in 2019, that market went totally out of control and just totally surged and forced them to come back into the market. So if that's the case, something that they're worrying about, they could stop QT and maybe shortly after begin to add more liquidity into the financial system by buying treasury bills, expanding their balance sheet. So that's something to look out for this this meeting. But I think the even bigger problem that we should look at going forward on the Fed is what they do with their final balance sheet. So even though they're not shrinking it anymore, what's its composition like? So there's talk that the Fed wants to have a treasury-only portfolio. Right now, a lot of it is in about $2 trillion is in MBS. And there's also talk that they want to hold more treasury bills and fewer coupons. Now, this matters a lot because, so as Johnny mentioned earlier, so the long end hasn't traded well, but part of it is weaker demand from pension funds and so forth. But in the past, I've noticed that whenever the long end is not doing well, we have news that maybe Treasury will issue less. And we saw that in Japan, right? The Ministry of Finance issued fewer longer dated JGBs, and that helped the market a lot. Like Jim mentioned, there's a lot of things the authorities can do to try to manipulate the supply and demand of Treasuries. And what the Fed officials are talking about right now, and this isn't finalized, we've only heard from a few people, this is something we'll hear in the coming meetings, is they might hold a portfolio that has much shorter duration than they have now, and that would increase the supply of treasuries, upward pressure on rates. And one of them, one of the more hawkish members, actually wants to sell MBS outright. So one thing I'll note is that the people who are actually the super hawks on the balance sheet are actually Trump appointees, and these are also guys that have been clamoring for rate cuts. And so in thinking about whether or not the executive would take over the central bank, I think in time they will. But so far, I think that the Trump appointees have been saying things to make President Trump happy, rate cuts, but on the other hand, are talking pretty hawkish on the balance sheet. So that tells me that it's not a Trump Fed just yet. It could be in the coming months, but today it isn't.
Thank you, Joseph. A really good in-depth overview there. And I'll be the first to admit, a lot of the market things, a lot of the macro, I can't fully grasp. And so it's really nice to have these breakdowns and even the occasional disagreements that happen. It's perfect for me. This has been a really good panel so far. We've got about 3 minutes until we get some data, and we'll take our normal little few-minute pause while the panelists kind of look things over on that. But leading into it, and if we have to pause in the middle of the question, that's perfectly fine. Don't worry about it. We got time to come right back to it. I want to take a look quick at yields a little bit. So we noted last time that classic 2-year to 10-year inversion is partially reversed at this point. Although that's true, real yields do remain pretty elevated, and the term premium is near multi-year highs at this point. Does this signal renewed market optimism about growth? Or is it, as one of the other panelists said earlier in the panel, just concerned that inflation will stay higher for longer? Last bear than Johnny, do you want to take a look at that one?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people have talked about the yield curve. I think it hasn't really reacted. It hasn't provided as much of a signal as it seemed to have reliably over prior cycles. I've pointed this out, I think, when we've talked about it before, but I would just note that the tools of monetary policy have changed pretty substantially, even in the past, let's say, 15 years. That might make that less of a reliable signal, both with the level of intervention, direct intervention, the terms, and you know, in the form of sort of large scale asset purchases, i.e., QE or QT, as well as sort of forward guidance that's really explicitly meant to be sort of a soft form of yield curve control. So, messaging to the long end, what the Fed's expectation is over, not just tomorrow but the coming years ahead. Which should have an influence over, you know, how that 2-year trades in particular. So I just think that there's a lot of noise, and I think it's tough to draw too much of a firm opinion on it. I think if that has been your reliable sort of indicator
it probably hasn't worked out too well so far this cycle. So I just remain a little bit cautious about it. Not to say that it's not something, you know, that might sort of work out as a signal at some point, but just that the tools of monetary policy really are different today than they were in prior cycles.
I would agree 100%. First of all, when the yield curve inverted originally back in whenever it was, there was all this talk, I guess it was 22 when the Fed was hiking. There was all this talk about it's a surefire signal of a recession. That certainly didn't happen. Now we're in the reverse situation where the Fed is cutting. Oh, wow. Now we've got some Jeff Schmidt dissented in favor of no rate cut. The Fed's going to stop shrinking its balance sheet. Joe's quite right about that. And Moran dissented in favor of a half point cut. Anyway, getting back to what I was saying, you know, there was this fear that if the Fed is cutting aggressively while inflation is still hanging around 3%, the long end of the curve could sell off and you'd have a much steeper yield curve. Well, that also hasn't really happened. It's been stuck at around 50 basis points, the 2-10 spread, for a year and a half now. And it just seems that the ultra long end of the curve and the 10-year point, right now the 10-year point is kind of anchored to 4%. And so the long end of the curve has behaved quite well. It doesn't seem like concerns over inflation have really affected it as much as many people would have expected.
Thank you, Johnny Last Sparrow. All right, it looks like we've got a little tickle of information here now. Looks like the 25 bips on the table. Like I said, we'll let the panelists look things over a little bit here. They will say much more intelligent and interesting things than I will glancing over things. So bear with us for a moment while we take it in. Now, I know that there are a lot of abbreviations, and so while we're kind of glancing things over, anybody who's looking at the note, there are a lot of terms like FF rate, IORB, SRF, on RRP, discount window. While we're kind of looking through some stuff to harp on here, would anybody care to just kind of differentiate what some of that stuff means for the audience? And I'm also curious about the two dissents Johnny mentioned. Is there any kind of, are we looking at any kind of infighting via these two dissents? And in the last one, we also had dissension to the rate cut.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say, it's like I said before, it's a very divided committee here. We have a couple of hawks, Jeff Schmidt and Alberto Musalem, if I've pronounced his name correctly. And then you've got the doves, Bowman Waller, and the uber dove, Moran. So it's quite a divided committee, you know, but two dissents is quite something. It's probably going to get worse.
There's also a balance sheet decrease of $5 billion in treasuries and $35 billion in MBS. Joseph, are we looking at, back on that topic of culling the QT, are we seeing evidence of that here today?
So what they announced was the end of QT, but not today, to be effective in, I believe, December. So like some analysts have suggested, the Fed is concerned that they might be overdoing QT, and so they're going to stop the balance sheet shrinkage. Now, the two things going forward is to see whether or not they will have to re-expand their balance sheet by buying treasury bills, because interest rates continue to have upward pressure, the repo rates are. And the most important thing to look forward for today, from my perspective, is if there's any further discussion on the ultimate composition of the Fed's balance sheet. Are they really going to have more bills, fewer coupons, which of course increases the supply of duration, upward pressure on interest rates, and of course, whether or not they're going to sell MBS, which would really upset the president and be bad and put upward pressure on mortgage rates. And also one thing about to note about the dissent is this guy is a Fed president and he is a hawk. And no, Governor Moran, of course, is the president's man there. So there was some fear that next year, because the Reserve Bank presidents would be up for reappointment earlier next year, if there was a Trump Fed board, that they could have significant influence over whether or not you could, whether or not we could, they reappoint these Fed presidents, and so this dissenting Fed president could be out of a job. But so far, because of the court case that is preventing Governor Cook from being replaced, so far, it doesn't seem like they have the power to significantly reshape the FOMC by controlling who is appointed a Fed president. So Fed presidents don't have to be nominated and confirmed by Congress. It's a much lower standard.
I'll jump in. Has the dual mandate risk, have they flipped at all? I don't know what you guys think. They seem to be more focused on employment than inflation risks. Do you pick up on that, or what are your guys' thoughts?
Yeah, they've always been like that. That's kind of why we have 3% inflation, and looks like we'll have that for the foreseeable future. I think it's just part of the culture and politics of the moment. I mean, if you look at what President Biden, when he nominated Fed board governors, he nominated a whole bunch of people that, you know, weren't really good at macro, but had strong backgrounds in labor. And it looks like that's still going to be the case today.
All right. Does anyone have anything to add to those points before I rope us back in? All right, so I'm going to take us back. We were last discussing the 2 to 10 year inversion, and the last point we were kind of tickling there was about a signal of renewed market optimism and growth, or just concern about inflation staying higher for longer. The follow-up I wanted to tag on here, and I hate to throw this caveat into the fray, is market optimism as a whole, just in equities, seems to be founded mostly in the boom generated by NVIDIA and other powerhouses in the AI discussion. I'm just curious how people feel about that. Is this just unwarranted optimism? I know one thing that comes up in discussion a lot would be like OpenAI. They've got a lot of contracts. I think it's like $1.5 trillion worth of deals between other companies with the government. And from what a lot of criticisms toward that is that there's not a whole lot to show there. And there's this constant discussion about a bubble. Is it a bubble? Is the market way too optimistic here? Or are, you know, dissidents to the AI explosion wrong? Anyone, feel free to jump on that. I know it's a pretty loaded one.
I'll jump in. It feels a lot like 97, 98, in my opinion. I think it's got some legs. You've got the Fed having no choice but to shift to easing, and the market's embracing that and redeploying it to high. You know, this goes back to, I put a post on Twitter. I think U.S. yields are telling you it's more worried about a debasement trade than anything else, and having, you know, that asset inflation and that liquidity finding its way to a small component of the economy that is driving all of the growth. AI is real. It's there. There's trillions of dollars being, you know, about to be spent. There was a big announcement by Brookfield, Canadian company that moved to New York, with $100 billion in 80 to 100 billion to build nuclear facilities to fuel these data centers. So there's a lot of we're still in the throes of it. So I there's a lot of incestuousness in regards to vendor financing among, you know, NVIDIA and everybody else. And, you know, how's it going to end? Is it going to end in a bubble? Probably. But I think we've got a lot of juice here, and it's going to take some time for this while this continues to play out. In the end, maybe I'm a little more pessimistic. I think this reminds me a lot of what happened in China when they built out these empty cities, and there was a lot of economic benefits from China, and that drove energy prices. And I'm seeing a similarity with data centers. I think we'll get efficiencies, and maybe we'll be knocking down data centers in 10 years or 5 or 10 years when they've been overbuilt.
I want to give a shout out to Martin and Johnny here. Last time we were asked this question, I thought we were, I still do think we're in a bubble, but Martin was quite positive on the market, and Johnny wisely counseled to not get in this way. And here we are today, making new all-time highs basically every single day. So great calls for both of them.
Well, when you got money in the market, you got to participate with it, but you got to be careful about the drawdowns. But, you know, there's just so much flow and liquidity. I think people really need to get an understanding of liquidity and how it influences the market, because there are segments of the market. We talked about auto loans, talk about private credit. There are segments of the market that's a dog's breakfast out there, and you don't want to own that for your clients as a portfolio manager. Otherwise, you won't be a portfolio manager. And all that money, like in Canada, I'll talk a little bit about Canada here, but foreign investors, Canada, we've been, despite the TSX, actually the Canadian market did better than the US market this year. Yeehaw. You can thank gold producers for that, because, you know, we although the Bank of Canada in Canada doesn't own any gold, we do have miners. So that's been beneficial to the TSX. But on the flip side, everybody's moving capital flows. It's $84 billion of net capital outflows from February to May into the U.S. and foreign securities, mostly U.S. And foreign investors are moving money out of Canada into the U.S. and it's going into those tech stocks. So there's a big vacuum there, and it's sucking up capital away from other countries and other segments into that one area, and that's a lot of momentum that you don't want to be, you know, short.
Yeah, I agree. The other thing that that's worth pointing out is that the rally that we had during 2023 and 2024 was purely driven by an expansion in the PE ratio. As far as the S&P 500 is concerned, it was purely expanding PE ratios, and earnings growth was pretty non-existent. In the last three quarters, we've had very, very strong earnings growth, earnings per share growth, which has driven the rally in the S&P. And it's going to be the same in the current quarter. I think year over year, the S&P is up about 16% or so. Something like 12 of those percentage points is EPS growth, and the rest is a slight expansion in the PE ratio, something like that. But, you know, this is not just like the blow-off top that we saw in 1999, where PE ratios just went to the moon. This is actually grounded in solid earnings growth. But I do agree that, you know, eventually it'll end in tears. I mean, it always does when things get crazy like this. But right now, what we've got is a lot of these big companies, they are pouring tons and tons of money into AI infrastructure and development, because they're frightened of losing out in a competitive battle with everyone else who's doing it. And I think it is a little bit similar to the midway through the internet bubble. And if you think back, you know, we had all these different internet explorers, you know, there was, well, kind of showing my age here, but Netscape and all these other ones that just fell by the wayside. And there's only one now, that's Google. So I think a lot of these companies that are pouring loads and loads of money into AI, they just feel like they've got no choice, because otherwise they're going to be the ones that fall by the wayside.
Man, Netscape brings me back. I just remember being like 5 or 6 at my grandma's house, and you had to boot Netscape off a freaking CD.
Yeah. Yeah. On a dial-up connection. Yeah.
So I Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to hop in. I mean, I do think that one thing that you can look at is just like where, if you're trying to figure out, okay, everyone kind of agrees, maybe there's going to be an overbuild. When's it going to happen? You got to look at like where's the money coming from? So like as it transitions from purely being, you know, hyperscaler operating cash flow, which it really was for let's say a year or two, to, you know, branching out where Microsoft takes a little bit of a step back and then a second tier hyperscaler Oracle comes in and picks up the thing, and then you're going out to SoftBank and you're going out to the Saudis, and then, you know, Meta's now going with Blue Owl to fund their thing, and, you know, Oracle's raising debt. Like, you're moving out sort of the pockets of financing from being sort of totally riskless to being more and more debt focused is a progression of that sort of process. And so the question is, when does the money run out? And at that point, I think is whether it's funding for, you know, someone like an OpenAI to be able to fund, you know, be able to operate at such negative cash flows as they, you know, grow share and try to take over, you know, that can happen as long as as those sort of funding channels are open. So we've seen it sort of move out along the risk curve, you know, from the most reliable to you know, less stable structures, and I think that'll be the thing to watch.
So I'm just curious, like not to harp on it for too long, but kind of tying in our discussion on inflation as a whole at the top of the show here, combining that with what seems to be, you know, pretty euphoric buying in equities, as Joseph noted, it seems like every single day we're getting a new all-time high across the board. Gold has been doing crazy shit this year, for lack of a better word. Are U.S. markets underestimating how much foreign policy turbulence could affect inflation in the markets as a whole, or is this just how it is now?
I mean, I guess I would say that there's no way to look at the market and not at least have some sort of flashbacks, at least 2020-2021, in terms of, you know, zero revenue companies that are going up 800% in a couple months. And, you know, it feels like just a chasey, FOMO-y market where, yeah, there's probably a lot of fundamental good stuff in it, but as it continues to sort of, you know, get into less and less sort of believable or higher out on the risk curve, whatever you want to say, there is a level of froth that I think is that, you know, that few people would deny. And I think that you can also look at things like the level of leverage in the market, whether that's sort of the old school margin leverage, you know, kind of statistics, or whether that's the amount of call options buying that's happening, which has now, you know, exploded again to new record highs over the past month or two, as you've seen these, you know, really speculative type names just go through the roof. And so it's just, to me, it's sort of a signal on where the broad market sentiment is. And, you know, even if, you know, we saw a little bit of this back, I would say, starting November or so of last year. And then that kind of led to at least a short-term correction that was, you know, pretty significant. I would say in the first quarter of this year, leading into Liberation Day and whatnot. So even though the economy didn't collapse, there wasn't a recession, there still was a significant sort of rebound from a euphoric sentiment in the market. And so that is something that I think you need to be aware of.
Well, I also add that, you know, what we see in the U.S., we see it everywhere in the world. Look at the Nikkei, look at the FTSE, look at Euro stocks, right? Everything is going to the moon. So this euphoric sentiment that the last bear mentioned, it's something that's everywhere. And maybe it really is just a whole bunch of people buying calls. And after all, that's worked really well.
I think we're ignoring the elephant in the room, gold and silver. It's telling you a lot. And everyone's trying to figure it out. And, you know, there's all kinds of different explanations. The one I'm leaning towards is more of the debasement, the Fed losing control in regards to the U.S. government that's spending like it's a financial crisis. And that's not being curtailed. And it's not just, if you go talk to Joseph, it's not just the U.S. Hey, we're getting our budget this week. We're talking like for Canada, this is massive, the biggest we've had since COVID. It's like $100 billion. And it's not just Canada, it's everywhere else. France has had its debt downgraded. Canada It's got the second worst household debt in G7. It's terrible. When you include, everyone's looking at Canada's federal debt, saying, yeah, it's okay, it's much better than the U.S., but you include provincial debt, which you should, we're terrible. We're worse than the U.S. And the only component that hasn't increased is our federal debt, and that's ballooning out, and that's going to have consequences. So I think the global trend is reckless fiscal spending, and that's debasing, you know, currencies, debasing and inflating. People saying, okay, I can't be exposed to that, and that's why these markets are moving higher, and in addition to what's happening in the tech space.
I just want to jump in with a couple of points there. I don't disagree. The U.S. Deficit and the debt to GDP ratio is going in the wrong direction. But, you know, in Europe, there is some pretty good progress among some of the countries. The problem children from the European debt crisis are now very well behaved. Greece, Italy. Italy's deficit this year, deficit to GDP ratio, could drop below 3%, and certainly it's budgeted to drop below 3% next year. I mean, that's an incredible achievement. So they're doing really well. Spain is also in pretty good shape. Here in the UK, we're not in great shape, but we're about to get some pretty hefty tax rises to try and correct things. But the US, you know, hasn't really done much so far to get the deficit under control. But one way to fix that problem is to maintain very high nominal growth, and then your debt to GDP problem kind of gets inflated away. And to some extent, that's the strategy, or seems to be.
That was absolutely beautiful. I love the constant, like, in referencing between hosts, the mutual respect, the eagerness to learn on these panels. It just goes to show that everybody's learning about this stuff all the time. And the panelists that we have on here, you guys are so friggin' smart. And you still show this eagerness to get another point of view, to get more in-depth explanations on something you're not hot on. And I know a lot of you see the Twitter landscape. That's just so rare lately, it seems. And so I am just basking in this. Thank you guys so much. I want to touch one more market-related thing, and I'm kicking myself in the ass for not doing it with Jem here. I know he tends to have to go off and do something else around that 2 p.m. mark, so this is my fault for not doing this while he was here. But I want to take a quick aside before we get to J-Pal's presser about liquidity conditions and margin debt still looking pretty elevated relative to prior cycles. And I'm wondering if volatility spikes from these levels, could we see financial stability concerns outweigh inflation progress in shaping the Fed's tone? I guess a little more specifically, at what threshold in the VIX or funding spreads would policymakers shift their tone in the presser? Joseph, your thoughts?
So I think you make a really good observation that there's an enormous amount of leverage in the market. We've all seen those charts on margin debt. Something else to keep in mind is that a lot of people have been expressing leverage through options, and options volumes are soaring. And there are also charts showing that retail options buying is at historically very, very elevated. So that does create fragility. So I think if we do have a big correction in the market, another way to think about that is, you know, a lot of wealth, a lot of dollar value just kind of evaporates. And so when you think of debasement in the sense that, yes, you know, the government is printing a lot of treasuries and so forth, a lot of value, a lot of, you know, fiat value that we have is just tradable stuff, like equity markets value, and that can go poof. And so when that happens, and it looks like, you know, when you go straight up, oftentimes you correct violently down. When that happens, maybe inflation just won't be a problem anymore. Maybe we'll go back to worrying about prices too low, at least temporarily. I don't really think that. So we've seen a lot of commentary from the Fed, and also their financial stability report suggesting that equity values are historically quite high. So I think it'd probably take a notable wobble for them to actually be concerned about anything, because prices are so high right now.
If I can just add on to that, I think one interesting dynamic that we kind of touched on earlier is whether you have sort of this monetary plumbing question and how does that tie into the rest of the system. So, like, for example, we talked about, you know, repo rates kind of spiking, some increased use of the Fed's primary credit or discount window. You know, whether or not if you had a situation where there was some sort of intervention, so to speak, into these sort of monetary markets. I think that the way that the Fed would say that and how they've, you know, kind of talked about that side of monetary policy is that it's not supposed to be, you know, those balance sheet decisions, tweaks around the edge are not supposed to be indicators of, you know, of their broader stance, and hence the famous, you know, not QE, asset purchases kind of concept. But if they were to come in, what would the broader market take away from that, regardless of what the Fed's sort of, you know, how they want to explain it? Would it be perceived as liquidity positive and accommodative? And could that, you know, how does the market take that? So I think that there is, you know, because there's so much leverage, you kind of have a little bit of instability at the base. And if you, you know, would they intervene in the case that you have a 20 basis point spike in repo rates? Probably, yes, I think that they would. Now, would that be taken as a signal for the market that, you know, the Fed is for sure going to have your back at every single bump along the road? Also, probably, yes. So it's that's kind of a dynamic that I'll be looking at.
Household debt in the U.S. is only like 68% of GDP. It's like well over 100 in Canada. So people in the U.S., the boomers are booming. They have money and they're spending it. And they're doing YOLO spending, and that's going to continue to drive services inflation. I know a lot of people that have moved down to Florida from Canada, and with their businesses and servicing into the services sector, health and lifestyle, exactly. And it's just on fire. It's incredible to see. And if you look at equities, I think the average is 40 to 50% of their net worth, and so equities keep pushing higher. Liquidity's is available out there. Household debt's low, and this is a smaller percentage of the overall population, and we're going to see a widening of the wealth gap continuing, and that's going to create a whole bunch of different challenges, in my opinion, around polarization. You look at what's happening in New York City with its mayor, and that's making international headlines, and people moving to the other extreme and creating instability. But having said, you know, answering your question, there's a lot of room for these things to continue to move higher.
Yeah, I just want to say a couple of things in support of that. If you look at household debt in the US, or household leverage, however you measure it, whether it's, you know, financial obligations, you know, the amount of interest they've got to pay each month as a proportion of their income, it's super low. The household sector has really, really massively deleveraged over the last 15 years. Same for the corporate sector. If you look at corporate interest payments as a percentage of profits, it's at a multi-decade low. So it's, you know, the household and the corporate sector have both massively deleveraged. The leverage has moved to the government sector. It's the government that's over-leveraged these days. So it's, you know, I just think if we do have a liquidity event, it's going to be very, very different to what we saw in the past. Whatever happens will be completely different, and it'll probably come from a source that no one was really expecting.
And Johnny, I think you had mentioned what's really interesting is that taxation. You mentioned Italy doing really well. They've done some major tax changes to attract people to move to Italy. I wish I could if the time change worked, because I was out there in spring. It was freaking awesome. But I'd be 250 pounds if I lived there. But tax changes are important. And if you look at in the UK, there's been, I think I read, like 16,500 millionaires have left or in the process of leaving.
Yeah.
And they're going to go and bring their capital with them to jurisdictions that want them. And those jurisdictions are going to benefit from it. In Canada, there's no room to increase taxes. And our tax, like, for example, I threw this number out last time. This will shock you. the average income required to buy a home in Canada is $210,000. That's in Toronto, Vancouver, the biggest cities. We consider you to be ultra rich, the richest of rich, and you get taxed at the highest tax rate, over 50% combined provincially and federally, at $240,000. So you're $20,000 shy of being taxed at the highest level, and that's the lowest level you need to buy a home. Canada is, pardon my language, fucked when it comes to that. If you look at the U.S. and other jurisdictions, there's a lot of room on taxation, and households are in a much better position from a leverage standpoint. So those jurisdictions are going to continue to outperform.
You know, that's interesting. I thought we were in a mess here, but, you know, I feel better now. Thanks.
Guys, we have a golden visa program, just so you guys know.
You got room for me in your basement? You got room for me and my family in your basement?
I was going to say, if those millionaires really need somewhere for that money to go, I got a couple of bank account numbers I can shoot over to them right quick. We can get this figured out in a few minutes. So speaking of a few minutes, J-Pal's presser is starting here in a few seconds. But before I flip our audio over to that and the video on the Unusual Whales YouTube channel, real quick, I've got four of our panelists left here. If you guys got something to plug, please plug the shit out of it. Where can people find you? Where can they go to learn more about what you do and what you got going on? Let's start off with Joseph and run right down the line.
Well, first off, thanks so much for having me. It's great being on this panel. If you guys are interested in hearing my thoughts on the FOMC, I will post a video on my channel on YouTube, Joseph Wang. All right, talk to you guys next time.
Hit me with some spice, last bear.
Yeah, follow me here on Twitter, and if you want to check out my Substack, please do. You can find the link in my bio.
Martin.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to some snow and some powder. If anybody ever wants to come and do some skiing, you know how to look me up. I'm the crazy Canuck up here. You got me on Twitter. Thanks so much for having me. It's such an honor to be among such awesome dudes on this panel.
Thank you for having me on the show. Yeah, it's been a real pleasure, especially with such great guests on the panel. If you want to follow me, take a look at my website, www.super-macro.com, or find me on Twitter, super_macro.
Beautiful. Everybody listening today, do that. If you're not following these guys, what the hell are you even doing? Why are you even on Twitter? Follow them. They have so much information and stuff to teach. You're really missing out if you're at all interested in the markets, especially the macro view. Follow these folks, everybody.